In your classroom, how does your privilege represent itself in the classroom? And I say that because I want you to consider how your classroom is set up and whether or not your mindset, your viewpoints, your ideals are presented throughout the classroom, or is it reflective and representative of your student body, or perhaps the content of what you're studying? Because far too often we'll walk into certain teachers' classrooms, right? And I know I've been guilty of this even myself at times, where the classroom represents me more than it does my students. And that should be the opposite, right? All of our conversations, including the layout of our classroom, what we put up on the walls, what we show on the screen, it should be student-centered. Hey, this is Ty.
And this is Joe. Welcome back to the 2B podcast.
That's right. We're two Black educators based out of Boston, and we are working towards Black excellence in every direction, every area. Joe, tell them a little bit more.
Oh, man. We are just working on improving ourselves, and we think a part of Black excellence is saying that, hey, it is attainable and showing you how to get there, as well as showing that our Black excellence is an integral part of society, and we should just all embrace it.
I'm with that. I like the way you put that. And with that being said, make sure if you are tuned in right now that you are following us on every platform. That means on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook, at 2BE Podcast.
YouTube. Oh, don't sell us short. Those are our social media sites, but you can listen to us in multiple places. Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Anchor, and I know I'm missing some, wherever podcasts are found. So that's please, right. And tell your friends.
Tell a friend to tell a friend.
Oh my goodness. Well, I am so excited. Okay, just a half pause. Can you believe we are like halfway through the halfway point of the year? It is June 11th. Sorry about it. Like lots of halfways. Like I'm just like actually coming to that as we're talking about it now. It's June 11. 2020 is halfway done.
I can believe it. And I believe for some folks who are resistant to change, some folks who are looking to stay the same, to not evolve, to not be a part of the revolution, they are hurrying up to saying to the calendar, please let 2021 get here quick, faster than a hurry, because they're not about this moment in time. But what they don't understand is, this is a movement, not a moment.
Ooh, this is a movement, not a moment. Actually, speaking of that, people are still out in these streets protesting for they are that movement. They are keeping us going and change is starting to come. How are you feeling about this?
I believe we're still at the beginning. There's still a lot more work to do. I understand feeling excited. I'm feeling like, you know, you hear a few politicians, a couple mayors have come out and said that they're going to make some strong changes to the budget of the police in their local towns and areas. We've heard some other politicians and activists come out and say that they're going to do some more advocacy work in terms of putting dollars and resources towards the Black community or towards culturally responsive learning. But at the same time, right now, we're hearing a lot of talk and we need to see more action. So I want everyone to stay vigilant, because as of right now, we've only seen a few, just a small handful of actions being taken. And right now, what day is it again? June 11th?
June 11th.
I believe Breonna Taylor's murderers are still at large. So
yes, they are.
There's still a lot more action to be done, because the three police officers that busted down her door and was at the wrong place looking for someone who was already in custody, they need to be held accountable for murdering Breonna Taylor.
Agreed. And when I think actually about this progress, while I am thankful, as you've already said, it's minimal. It's just starting. And I think about the protesters from our ancestors, and man, they were going strong. I think the shortest one I saw was like 76 days, but most of them were 6-7 months, over a year for the bus boycotts. Like, no, we've got to keep going until we see the full results that we are looking for. Our voices will be heard. We need to unite and we need to keep this going.
This is the message I want to really express to not just Black people, but our allies and those of us who really are strongly committed to this fight. And even those who only have one foot in, we are at a point now where you have to be willing to sacrifice. That was really the difference. That's the difference between our ancestors and where we are, is that oftentimes we are not willing to put in the sacrifice that's necessary to bring about real change. As you mentioned, you know, you can think about the boycotts, the sit-ins. Those went on for not days, not weeks, months, and for in some cases, over a year. And I just read something, and I don't know if I'm breaking news, but I just read it from Mark Lamont Hill. And I saw him post that.
I'm a fan.
Yes, that Starbucks has issued a statement to their employees that they are banning any apparel that states Black Lives Matter. So none of their employees can wear anything.
Canceled!
None of their employees can wear anything that says Black Lives Matter or anything of the such in that realm. And he, as his caption said, pay attention to what these companies do, not what they say. And all I'm going to ask all of our listeners is, are you ready to sacrifice your macchiato? Because that's what's going to take. Are you ready to sacrifice your vanilla bean chai frappe?
Oh, they're like, ooh, PSL. PSL is coming back. It's going to be fall in 3 months. I don't know.
Because that's where we stand. And for some folks, right now, when I said that, they've already cringed. They've already sat back in their chairs. I don't know. And that's really the issue. We need to get past that hump. Because when companies say things like that, where they don't seem to be really about the movement, they don't seem to truly be behind us, then we need to respond with our dollars. That is the way to really create change. And I'm going to continue to say that.
Conscious consumerism matters. We need to be conscious consumers. They listen when we hit their pockets. Mm-hmm. They listen when we hit their pockets. And the thing is, it's short-term dissatisfaction for long-term gains.
Absolutely.
And that's what we need to be thinking about. It's short-term satisfaction for long-term gain, because you are going to believe, not only does my life matter, my vote matters, my money matters, my music matters, my culture matters, and my education matters. And if you have a problem saying that, you have a problem with me saying that, then you have a problem with my money being put in your pockets.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Point blank, period. As my kids love to say.
Right.
And speaking about education, y'all asked, and we're back with our Janaea Little. And if you don't remember, she is from the Lesson Planned podcast. Apologies. The Lesson Planned podcast. She is on her way to Vanderbilt. And I just learned she is an Olympic weightlifter. She's here to do
a woman of many talents.
Right? Oh my goodness. She is here to do some of the heavy lifting right now with us. Janaea, where you at, girl?
Okay, I'm in.
Welcome.
How y'all doing?
Good.
Man, I'm just a child of God doing my purpose. That's all. But thank you for the introduction. Got me feeling all pressed about it. Oh man, so let's get this going.
let the fountain come out. Go ahead, bless us. Where we going?
I'm gonna let the man lead today. And see what he has to say before I jump all in, because I was curious about some things you presented to us before. So I'm gonna pause. It's an inside joke, guys. We got with each other. Go ahead, brother.
Well, actually, I wanted to jump in with the check-in and ask you, Janaea, how have you felt in response to what you've been seeing said by some of the politicians in regards to their support for Black Lives Matter, from some of the companies that have issued their support either through statements or through commercials, tweets, and whatnot? What is your feeling surrounding that? Are you excited? Are you overjoyed? Are you a little bit wait and see? Talk to us.
Okay. Y'all can hear me? We good? We here? All right. I'm on a wait and see. I need to see some consistency, because there has been constant consistency of our dollars going into these pockets. So I need to see if they are really about what they're saying. If and really really to all the audience members listening, try to go deeper, not just to what the businesses are saying on their public platform. Look who are on their shareholders, those people who are on their lobby for those companies, all those things. Because you'd be surprised what companies invest or hire lobbyist companies that go into Congress and push and push and push and write laws that Congress passes that affect Black and brown bodies. You'd be surprised what companies, I'm not saying any because I want to be sure I'm 100% sure, but I really encourage and push us to make sure that none of these companies are tied with the prison system. That's the problem. If you have relations and the prison system that is set up for Black and brown bodies to be in there, and see who they're really making a profit off of and what they're really doing. And, you know, we get upset when we hear that making our products because they're in sweatshops, and that is very problematic. And that's not just problematic, that's wrong. We should also double check and triple check to make sure that these companies are not doing things that are against or not investing in our community.
Right.
100%. 100%. Mm-hmm. It is up to us again. It's up to us to do.
Y'all there? Can y'all hear me?
We can hear you. You got a little bit of echo going, but, you know, we'll press on. But it is up to us to do our research. It is up to us to do that. We have to be the ones who are being conscious of where we are spending our money. And dear Black entrepreneurs, get these businesses going because we don't have enough. Like, I'm ready to give you my money. Please, please. We are still waiting for many more Black businesses to fill in these spots where I am no longer shopping.
I hear that. We definitely need to fill in the gaps. And specifically, I think we need to really put forth community efforts where we sort of create a guild in your community, in your city, in your town, in your neighborhood, where you see what gaps there are and then begin businesses to fill in those gaps. So, you know, I don't want to categorize or stereotype us as certain type of entrepreneurs, but I will say that there's an abundance of Black companies in certain spaces. And those would be health and beauty. And we have a lot of entrepreneurs in that space. We have a lot of entrepreneurs in culinary endeavors. And we need to make sure that we expand. You know, if I need a plumber, I need to have a Black plumber that I can call. If I need an electrician, I need to have a licensed electrician that I can call. And not only that, by registering as a minority-owned business, that puts you in line for government contracts, for city contracts, where you can then go beyond and extend beyond your neighborhood, where you're not only servicing your people, but then you're also receiving government dollars. So it's really imperative that we look amongst ourselves and say, okay, what skill set is missing? And then really try to cultivate some folks, whether it's our youth or a few people that we know are skilled tradesmen, to get into those fields right now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Ty, you dropping a bunch of knowledge. I guess we're going to have episode 12 on that. Oh my goodness.
I'm ready to talk dollars.
Yes, I'm sorry. My bad. I had to leave and come back and figure it out. Yeah, I agree with I heard some of what you said and how we can figure out how to put money in the back in the Black community. Even if you can't access a Black owned bank, let's start a pot. Y'all know what I know the Asusu. That you see me saying? Mm-hmm. I know what my West Indian brothers and sisters be doing. Like, let's put it for somebody. All right, you put 200, 200, 200, then you take out. We can figure things out. We've been doing it that's the thing. We've been taught. Gosh, don't let me start on education. Do you get explicitly taught the greatness of you in education?
Mm.
No, you don't. Let me pause. Let me do it again. Are you explicitly taught the greatness and the excellence of you and the people who look like you? I'll wait. Oh, you don't. So, we don't. So,
right. Drop that on them.
Not knowing that our communities, not knowing like the fact that we built up communities and industry in a time where it's blatant now, but it was a time where it was so blatant, like they would just pull you from walking down the street and lynch you. You know, like a picnic comes from us. Can I say it? What picnic comes from?
By all means.
Picnic comes from picking, and they will go pick somebody who was so. We have to understand that even if our ancestors did it in that time when we experienced such oppression, that we can do it even now. And we have to really be in our schools, whether you're Black or white, whatever your population is, you need to learn how to celebrate them and fill them and pour into them joy. You have to pour into joy that they can do these great things and they come from greatness. And not just the struggle. You don't really gotta teach Black and brown kids about the struggle. It's like they know.
I mean, I don't even think you need to teach white people about the struggle. They know too. Let me rephrase. I don't think you need to teach white people about, Black people used to be slaves. They know. Can we also present Black people?
That's why I want us to push not just for July 7th, but
so I see we're having some technical difficulties with Janaea, but I think it's important that we continue this conversation. And I want to just get right into it, Joe, because I have a question for educators as we continue to talk about how to combat racism in education. I want our brothers and sisters of a lighter persuasion, right? Our white brothers and sisters to ask themselves, let me take a step back. In your classroom, how does your privilege represent itself in the classroom? And I say that because I want you to consider how your classroom is set up and whether or not your mindset, your viewpoints, your ideals are presented throughout the classroom, or is it reflective and representative of your student body, or perhaps the content of what you're studying? Because far too often we'll walk into certain teachers' classrooms, right? And I know I've been guilty of this even myself at times, where the classroom represents me more than it does my students. And that should be the opposite, right? All of our conversations, including the layout of our classroom, what we put up on the walls, what we show on the screen, it should be student-centered.
Agreed, 100%. Because representation in the text is very important, but representation in the classroom is equally as important, I would say. Like, because sometimes I'm gonna have an off day and I may not engage with the material that day. But when I walk in, I want to feel inspired. Mm-hmm. I want to feel inspired. And I think it is important that we put up images. And I don't mean just Harriet Tubman. I don't mean just Martin Luther King. I don't mean just Malcolm X. What about the living people who are contributing to the lives of Black people right now, who are doing incredible things in science, in math, in innovation, in invention? What about them? Stop just telling us about people from before. Incorporate that we are still doing great things now.
Absolutely. And that's why I think, and again, I want to repeat this question because it's imperative that we ask and I'll put up on the screen. And that is, how does your power and privilege show up in your work with students? How does it take up space? Or more importantly, how does it silence others? Because that's often what happens, is that maybe your intention is not to belittle or to be dismissive of other cultures, other ideas, but that's what comes to be in the classroom. Janaea, I see you're back. I want you to jump in on that. Can you hear us? I'm not sure she can hear us.
I'm not either. Oh, no.
I'm going to try to reboot my Wi-Fi. I'll be right back.
Okay.
All right. We'll continue. We'll press on. So to further that point, I think that the way that you really consider answering that question is through the imaging that you have in your classroom. We all know that, especially Generation Z, right, and millennials, but certainly with Generation Z, they learn through imaging. Most of what they inject into their spirit, into their psyche, is through social media, which oftentimes is videos, it's clips, it's YouTube, it is images and pictures that are shown. There's even been studies done that show that children under the age of 16 do more watching of TV or experiencing information through their phone than they do the television. So they're not watching CNN. They're not watching MSNBC. They're finding out through their social media. So the same thing should apply in the classroom. What images are you presenting? And as you mentioned, Joe, I want to pick up from where you said, we need to, no matter what subject you're in, we need to start to post images in our classroom that are more culturally representative, and specifically representative of people, Black and brown people, that are still alive today, right? So as an English teacher, I want to talk about Angela Davis, our queen, Angela Davis, who's still alive, right? She's a fantastic writer, activist. I mean, I can go on with the accolades. Pictures of her in the classroom, right? We can also talk about other authors and activists. And then when you start branching out into your specific subject is the word I'm looking for, then there are people that are pioneers in that space that are still alive today, or more so, even if they died recently, then there's more of a connection point to them than who those folks who may have passed on hundreds of years ago.
100%. And I think that something actually that you told me was give, for those who are alive, the cool thing is you can give their social media handles. So you might say, hey, after you read this, maybe tweet a quote. You know, use social media to engage with the author. You never know, you might get a response. I remember back in the day, it was like, write letters, right? We would write letters to our authors in hope of a response. And now that's the same thing. So that's taking something that we used to do and bringing it into an age in which it is accessible to your learners and makes them want to engage with the material. It's 100% possible.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, this week, my students are reading a story called The Palm Tree Bandit by an author named Nnedi Okorafor, my Nigerian sister, and she's still alive, right? So again, like you said, part of the assignment I posted with her bio, I gave her Twitter handle. I posted a TED Talk that she had done recently. So my students watched the video and a lot of them gave me great feedback saying that they learned a lot from hearing her talk about her reasoning behind writing, her themes that she utilized. And many of them connected with her, even though she's not their age. It's nice that they're able to see that she's still living in this moment here and now. And maybe some of them have reached out to tweet at her, to connect with her. And hopefully what I'm hoping is that it inspires them to want to become writers and use their voice to elevate not only their thoughts, but the thoughts of their community, the thoughts of their peers as well.
Absolutely. 100%. Welcome back, Janaea. Welcome back. I think we're golden.
I was like, Lord, make it so. I'm just trying to disseminate some knowledge.
Yes. I just want to continue. I'm fired up about this. So, you know, studies show that Eurocentric values and content truly dominate U.S. schooling, right? So we have to really take a moment and say, all right, since we know that to be the case, how then can I become more inclusive of my students in terms of what my environment shows? And I think the other thing that's really important is a lot of teachers use PowerPoints or Google Slides as part of their everyday presentation in class. And I'm really intentional about the imaging that I show. So if I can, I'll use a photo of a young Black boy shown in a classroom being scholarly. I'll use a photo of a young Latinx woman who is shown in a position of leadership. And those images, then they're internalized by my students because now they see themselves on the screen. They see themselves doing things other than what maybe their history books have showed them, like the constant images of slavery, the constant images of Black people being shown as illiterate, uneducated, unorganized, not really representative of our full identity. And those are the things that I think need to really be shown in the classroom if we want to truly combat racism, is tell the whole story, give the whole picture.
And also give alternate perspectives, because I remember my one of my professors in my human development class when I was getting my master's at UMass Boston, her name, Dr. Lisa Gonsalves, she said, often youth need to be presented the idea before they can internalize it for themselves. So they need to be presented with this alternative option to see themselves. And that's what we do as educators when we say, hey, did you know that you too could be a doctor? Did you know that you too could be a lawyer? You too could own your own business? You too could, whatever you want to do, if we present, you too could be an astrophysicist. Like, you can do all these things. And sometimes we just assume that they're like, of course I could do this. But no, presenting that and having them see themselves and having them imagine what it might feel like, what I might be able to do if I do this, is so powerful. And it helps them to internalize and visualize themselves in this alternate space, which leads to them taking that action.
To that point, I want to flip that for a second, because right now we're talking about the effect that it has on the students. I think that it truly has a larger impact possibly on the teacher, the educator themselves, right? Because think about what are the narratives that you are telling yourself about the kids that are in front of you? Mm-hmm. And more so than that, how does that then affect how you see them as a student, as you see them as a learner? How does that affect your grading? We talked about and touched on it previously that, you know, when you don't believe in these children as much as, you know, someone that like our skin complexion, we automatically believe in their greatness. Then when they give you a little bit of effort, sometimes you go above and beyond and say, oh, that was fantastic. And you're selling them short because in the end, you know that when it comes to for the assessments, whether it be the state assessments or it comes time for graduation and they don't have their credits, or even if they graduate and you send them off into the world, you know they don't have the skill set necessary to be successful, you have done a disservice to that child.
It's I'm so glad to be back. Thank you. Thank you for your patience. I love how you, because I believe it too, we teach to our kids' future, but I love how we can address the now with the kids. Once you start telling the educators to change their mindsets on how, like you said, in the narrative, because I've had students bring me something and I'm just like, okay, and what I'm supposed to be happy about this? Because you put your name on something that's below you. It's not, when we teach our children, we're teaching to their whole person. It is not just what the grade they present. My students are more than just the grade. Okay, right. So let's take example today. We had an assignment to do writing an essay. We didn't do that because my students wrote a concern and demand letter to the superintendent, the mayor, and all of the schools, the leadership of the school. And we had a meeting today with the superintendent. These kids spoke and articulated themselves.
Mm.
You can't see that on a test. Not that way. Not that advocacy. Not that articulation in the moment. Not that understanding who they are as humans. And overall in the world, you can't measure that on a test. Mm-hmm. Not the way they presented to these kids now, especially these tests that aren't even connected or representative of the population they're serving.
Right. And what we're thinking as teachers about what are we presenting in front of our students? Are we giving them something that challenges them and helps them see themselves as contributing members of society when they leave? What you did is showed your students you are powerful even at 10 years old in fifth grade. Your voice matters. The superintendent is going to hear you. Change will happen because your words were spoken. Like you are the future, and we are going to start that future right now.
They made my little educator advocate's heart just explode, because my kids were asking, they were saying, hey, why don't we have curriculum that speaks to real world issues? And one student said, you know what, if we have curriculum that speaks to real world issues, we will be more invested because we can connect to it. I said, look at that, that's a child. Wait a minute, why they get it but you don't? That's what I said. I said, hold on. So that is one of the many things, or one student said, cops shouldn't be in school. She says school should be a comfort, a safe place.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are confused that, when we say not all cops are bad, we're saying that because all people aren't malicious, right? Mm-hmm. At the same time, this is a system in place that was started for after enslaved ancestors were freed to gather them up, right? Started from members of the KKK to gather us up and wrangle us up because we had to stay in our place. Kids understand that. They know that this is a force that may not always be for their best interest, that may not be there to protect them. They understand that, especially if you're in black and brown child and you live in the hood, you've probably seen somebody get arrested roughly. That may have happened in your life. Or just look at the media and what we see in TV, what we know. And these kids aren't stupid. So as we move into this conversation of decolonizing our minds and decolonizing the curriculum for teachers, we need to understand that these students come with a funds of knowledge. These students come with culture capital. These students are aware and very astute. Matter of fact, these students could survive a neighborhood that you wouldn't, not because it's dangerous, you just don't know the politics. You don't know how to have a conversation. You don't know what it really means. So you need to go respecting them, knowing that you are not a lecturer, right? You are facilitating their greatness. You are presenting an academic environment and space that helps them shine. And whenever they forget that, that's when you get in their face and you say, excuse me, did you forget? Let me help you remind you how awesome you are.
Mm-hmm.
Did you address decolonizing when I was gone? What that really looks like?
No, we didn't test that yet.
That's about to ask, how do you go from one assignment to another, realizing that that is what's necessary in the moment, and that is actually what is going to be culturally responsive. What is the thought process you go through to get there?
Okay, so first this is to our educators. For first year teachers, we understand a lot of times first year teachers, no matter what color you is, you nervous, you got to deal with these 25 kids or whatever. You got people coming in and out your classroom. So it may be hard to identify what is necessary to be culturally responsive. But what you do have to take the time to think as Ladson Billings says, Gloria Ladson Billings, culturally responsive educator, look her up. She's phenomenal. She's still alive. You can still learn from her.
Mm-hmm.
You can still learn from these contemporary historians. Angela Davis is still like, where y'all at? Because y'all still doing the same thing. You can still learn from them. Lisa Delpit, you can still learn from them. Christopher Endom, you can still learn from them. These are contemporary Black historians, right, who are educators changing the game. And she talks about teachers. Back to what I said, teachers have to think about what challenges the status quo. And to me, that's not necessarily something you need to learn in a book. That's humanity. That's a human being. Can you look at that child and say, am I treating them the way I would want to be treated? And if you can't answer that, maybe you need to find some love for yourself. I don't know. I don't think it's as deep as people make it in some way. The context, understanding how we got here, understanding the theories and the tools and all those things for your toolbox, that's important. But looking at a child, or any child, any student, and trying to say, I serve a predominantly Black and brown population in the South. I'm a history teacher. Is my history perpetuating white-centered power? Is my history that I'm teaching perpetuating white dominance? It's not that hard. It's just stop centering yourself. Stop looking about yourself and look at the kids you're serving. It's not that complicated. I'm a math teacher. I serve a predominantly Latino community in Texas. Maybe they're predominantly Mexican or Central American. It's not that hard. Are the images that you spoke of, Tyrell, representing the population I serve? It's not that hard to just think about how would you want to be reflected as a person. It's too much on Google to not help you. You know, that's just the basic stuff as a human being to do in your heart. For the context of it, decolonizing, we have to understand that that means colonize. Like you mentioned, who are the colonizers? Eurocentric. Okay. How are the colonizers operating now? They operate in a capitalistic. They operate in a white-centered, which is new. That came about 400 or 500 years ago, focusing on people who look a certain way. And it's cisgender. How can I not negate people who are white and cisgender, not make them feel bad, the goal. How can I incorporate other people? That's a step one in decolonizing your mind. How, as I, an educator, can make sure that even as a person of color, what I'm teaching, like I said earlier, isn't white, cisgender centered. Mm-hmm. That goes in, that can start with, like you said, the images when you're setting up your classroom, the images. When you're setting up your classroom, if you work in Black and brown schools, from what I understand as a person, a Black woman, Black people are demonstrative. I don't like when you call us loud. We're not loud. We're demonstrative. Okay. We're community oriented. We are joyful. Okay. So you want to know how a Black and brown child is going to learn? You can go to a Black church. That's one of the places they learn to communicate and follow somebody. It's a call and response. So when you're in front of the classroom, you don't just lecture and be boring. This is a call and response. You engage them. That's not hard. Go to their community. See how they operate in their community. It's not hard. Just go to a local park. Look how you'll see a kid. And this is basically, I'm talking about all relationships, right? If you go to a local park and you see kids joking around and roasting each other. Oh, they're not bullying. They're roasting each other. You learn something about, you know what I mean? Like, it's stuff that's common to us. But if you start to try to really cultivate relationships, and if you don't feel comfortable going to the park, if you don't feel comfortable going to the Black church, pay attention to your kids on the playground and see how they interact with each other.
In the lunchroom.
Yes.
In the hallways.
Exactly. Yes. Paying attention to what they're doing in front of you instead of just thinking about how, ooh, I wouldn't do that. It's not about you. It's not about you.
So I'm sorry. I just wanted to say, I really truly believe the root of building relationships in schools happens outside of the classroom. Mm-hmm. It's what moments in time are you spending with your kids when they're not there in front of you for an academic purpose? Because we understand, right? We're all under certain time constraints. As an instructor, I have so much content that I need to get through. I want to make sure that you're well prepared, you know, for everything beyond this space. However,
as well as I'm putting you under some stress during that time, because I want to get you to that place of proximal development where it's a little tough, but you can do it. So you're exactly my our you job mean. Isn't to be best friends, right? Well, I'm not my teacher's kid's best friend, but my job isn't to be your, like, communicate in that capacity. It's to push you. I'm like a coach in the gym, right? Olympic weightlifting. I'm putting some more weight on you so you can push and build that muscle. So, like you said, you really can't. They become comfortable with you because you're providing structure in a safe place. But getting to know them in other facets, like you said, has to happen outside of the classroom, because right now I'm just pushing you to that place where it's hard, but you can do it, but it's hard, so you only can focus on this.
Right. And similar to, like you talked about, like being a coach, a lot of times your coach is motivating you before you step foot into the gym, right? It's the YouTube link that they send you and say, you need to watch this, right? It's the moments that they talk to you after the workout and say, I see the progress. It's coming together. I like that. It's those motivating statements that they provide for you when not when the work is being done, but at an opportune time when it's, you know what, we're both here and I'm here to listen to you and I want to also build and connect with you. Man, there's so many great educators that I've seen that I want to praise right now for the time I've seen them spend before schools, after schools, playing with the students in the park across the street. Those are all the times where you want to create an inclusive environment, an anti-racist environment. Spend those moments learning about your students, and they want to learn about you too. You'd be surprised. Now, I'm not saying don't tell them all your personal business. Now,
don't. You're gonna get fired. Don't do that.
Don't tell them all your personal business.
And we're gonna come to be like, you're gonna get fired if you keep running. Don't do that. Right. That's not your friend.
We didn't tell you to do that.
We didn't tell you to do that.
But share with them some things about your life. I was surprised. So many of my students, especially my young Black girls, asked me throughout the year about my wife and my marriage, and I was like, you know, I had to tread lightly with some of those questions, but I understood that they were coming from a place where they wanted to know more about me in that aspect. Like, what was that aspect of my life like? And for various reasons, some of them were looking to gain understanding because they didn't see that in their own space. Mm-hmm. Others were looking to sort of bounce things off of me based on what they had seen on TV. So it really was, you know, a great conversation for us to connect on in a space where I was like, okay, let's talk about that after 2:30, right? Come see me in the classroom or in the hallway or wherever, and we'll chat. I have time.
So what y'all gonna have to do is, y'all listeners gonna have to listen to this again, because we're dropping gems. Not only is it the part about building your relationship and making sure you're not centering yourself, making sure you're not centering the curriculum. We're gonna talk more about the curriculum. But it is also putting yourself in a posture where you can learn how to challenge your kids above and beyond what has been taught to you. And what I mean by that is what we said earlier. You have to get into a place that I'm working in urban ed. You have to go on asset based. And that's when you go and learn the context and understand, well, I'm working in urban ed and it's still asset based, but these kids aren't in poverty, and all the kids aren't in poverty. Or these kids aren't low income, and all the kids aren't low income. Or do some kids have single parent? It doesn't matter. You have to go in with the asset base that this child can do anything they set their mind. And you have to teach yourself that. You have to go in and challenge yourself that. There's certain things like, we check your biases. Can't wait for you to talk about that. Check your biases. Understand where you are falling short, because you've been taught that this is what this is supposed to look like. And I'm going to push it out there. If you are a teacher, especially if you're a white teacher who does not live in the community, but you live a half hour away, you need to figure something out, because you have put yourself in a position where the only dynamic your kids have with you is in the classroom. So the only connection they have with you is that power dynamic. So they don't see you as a person outside of that. If you live a half hour away and you only come in the morning and leave in the afternoon. So if that's the case, you have to figure out ways for them to see you in other positions, because that power dynamic is white centered. That power dynamic is telling them that white people are in control at all times in some capacity, well, in schools. So even thinking about that, how can I change that power dynamic? Not saying you lose your authority, but how can you change that power dynamic so that kids don't just see you as an authority figure in the classroom, you know, that you have a humanity to you that they can connect with and you can connect with them.
relationships first. Like, I don't know how many times like that that's just going to be said, but relationships first. Like, ultimately, if you want students to learn, you have to build relationships with them. Like, they have to believe that you care about them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but it might be hard for someone to build a relationship with a kid from the city, especially let's just stick with the race thing, right? Taking out racism. You weren't even super wealthy too, but you're a white teacher who's never really lived in the Black and brown community. So you don't know what that looks like. It's foreign to you. You don't know. And you never stay there to learn about it. So are you really ever checking your biases? Are you really ever being challenged on your biases? I'm curious. I wonder that if you've always lived in a suburban town with predominantly white or whatever that those people who you work with, whatever, maybe not those people, but you know what I mean? And you go into another setting, are your biases checked? Are you really, or are you in that power dynamic? Because Tyrell just said, you can't build a relationship with the kid unless you have it outside of the classroom in some capacity. Mm-hmm. And it can't be when you're policing them. Go do this, go do that, get yourself. Not hallway duty, exactly. And then some teachers wonder why they don't have good relationships. You don't live here. And this is crazy because some police departments require you to live in the city you service in. So I
all need to.
All need to. But my point is, like, how can you, and I challenge teachers. Now, please don't come and gentrify the neighborhood. It's a precarious line. But I just am confused how you live 30 to 45 minutes away and you only see these children in this 45 minute to 90 minute block, whatever it may be. And then that's it. How do you build a relationship with them? And how do you do center whiteness in the power complex?
I mean, I still feel like a lot of these things can be done inside of the classroom in the way you even address, even in the way you address teaching. Mm. I truly believe that because unfortunately, I don't spend that much time outside of the classroom with my students. I show up at their games, you know, occasionally I support them, but like a lot of our relationship building happens in the classroom.
Let's call those options, right? Because some people don't have the best relationship skills in the classroom either.
I mean, fair, but that's what I'm saying. Like, ultimately, you're going to have to figure it out. Do I agree? That requires you, yes, to check your biases. How do I put myself aside to truly learn about you, right? How do I stop saying, you know, but we know how our children are, right? Mm. Like, because what is it about what are children, how are our children? Oh, well, you know, that won't help our children. We have to be realistic about our children and where they can go, right? Because my thing is, some of these teachers who are saying this have been teaching for 15 plus years. Some of them are in extracurriculars. So that it's not just that, it is really being able to see your kids as the scholars, as the, for we say growth mindset, right? And then we don't allow our kids to the room to also improve and grow. So I think that it is giving them the space to be able to do that. And in order to do that, you have to see them as capable of doing that. So when you think about Black students, when you think about your Black students and you first, and you're like, oh, they wouldn't be interested. You need to say, wait, why did I just say they wouldn't be interested? And think about, is that rooted in any kind of fact or interaction that you had with the student? Because yes, there are times where they're generally not interested. And you know this because one-on-one, I know the student isn't interested. But if that's not the case, you really need to think, did I say that perhaps because this is a Black student? Did I say this perhaps because this is a Black woman? Oh, science isn't for women? Like, we need to challenge these things. Math isn't for women. We need to be thinking about, why did I just say that? And saying what we mean. So in a different conversation, when we said, people say these kids are, that's not suitable for our kids. Replace that with what you really mean to say. What do you mean by that?
I would say that it's what you're saying is 100% correct. And I would say that for any members of your audience who are white educators, they need to hear what you said and make sure they challenge and hold themselves accountable to what they're saying, as well as anybody who even has that mindset. Because I agree with you. It's like this indoctrination that people have been taught that this is what that is. And I guess I understand, but I guess that's where our options come from with what Tyrell was saying, the options of exploring that person, because you have to see their humanity outside of the classroom in a sense, right? If you're pigeonholed and stuck in there, because if you can't, it's tricky. Do we give people trainings to have a relationship, to build relationships? Can you train somebody to really understand what it means to cultivate? But a part of me is just respecting that person. And then it goes back again. It's tricky. Tyrell said, it's like, we believe, some teachers really believe these kids can do anything they set their mind to. Anything. And I think it goes back to yourself, like you said, and what you're saying, why did I say that? Why am I believing that child? What have I seen? What have been taught? Or where have I struggled as a teacher that has put me in this place that I think kids are just like this, period? Because I don't know how to manage. And it goes back to the fact that it's going to be in my book, where you teach, why you teach, and what you teach, where you teach. Everybody's not meant to be in a certain place. That's just, you need to just understand that and reconcile that with yourself and not feel bad that you do not teach well with this demographic. Just understand it. I'm not even going to put a label on a demographic. You don't do well here. What you teach. Somebody told you to teach this. You're not good at it. You should figure it out the first year. Keep it pushing. Because if you don't have a passion for what you teach, the kids aren't going to be engaged and they don't have time for you. So that's going to be a problem. Where you teach and what you teach. Where you teach, why you teach, why you teach. There it is. That's the third one. I teach because I'm a steward of education. God has blessed me to have this skill and talent and ability. I believe education is not a career. It is something you have. The society has taught people that education is a job. Education is not a job. You cannot go into a school thinking, I'm just going to work this. And if you do, and somehow you realize you're good at it, good for you. Keep pushing. But if you do that and you realize it's not for you, you need to leave. I don't care if you did 4 years and got your certification, because certification does not mean qualification. You do not need to be in front of these kids. If you don't know why you're teaching, it's going to affect how you treat these kids. It's going to affect how you deliver your lesson. It's going to affect how you have teach to their future. I know why I'm in education, because it's not just my passion. I've been called to do this. It is important to me. And to decolonize our minds again, especially if you are, your ancestors are from West Africa, or your mama, your daddy, your grandma is from West Africa. We come from the lineage of the griot. That's why I call myself the griot. They were honored educators. They kept the law. They were musicians. They were respected. What happened to those places where people were respected as educators? And what we have to do now is implement culturally responsive strategies for people so they can learn and try to do that, because the society doesn't teach them to be feel honored as an educator and understand why they're teaching. People go in as a job. So first, if you go in as a job, you should just leave. It's not for you. Two, if you're not going for it as a job and you really wanted passion and you're really trying to cultivate yourself, let's think of some ways that you can do better. One, ask your administration to send you to professional developments around anti-racism. Advocate for that. If an administration doesn't want to send you, something's wrong with that administration. If they can't say, we can't do it this month, but we'll do it in 3 months, something's wrong with that administration. And if they don't want to bring somebody, if they don't want to send you, bring somebody in. You ask them, do your research, ask your administration, your school district. It is their responsibility and their mandate as educators to train their educators, not just to be able to deliver curriculum, but to deliver curriculum culturally responsibly. Have people come in and teach you not to just center yourself. Have people come in and train you consistently on how to challenge the status quo. The status quo being, oh, these kids will only be XYZ. That's wrong. Have you be trained so that you can deliver the best for your students. Okay, you did that. You had your administration bring somebody in. You did your research. You guys are getting trained on a regular basis. It's muddy, it's complicated, but we're figuring it out. Cool. Next thing you know, you get books by Lisa Delpit. You listen to podcasts like this. You expose yourself to other challenging conversations. You go to a person of color. And I know people are not about this. Unfortunately, there are some spaces that require and say, hey, my friend, where have I fallen short? Have I said microaggressions to you? Be honest. Tell them, please tell me the truth. Not teach me. Just tell me the truth. Have I fallen short? If you don't have a person of color who's your friend, that's fine. ask somebody.
No, it's not. You better make one.
No. I'm saying that's fine. You should. Some people ain't in that space. They still live in the boondocks, you know, with like Bob. You know.
Well, here's what I want to know though. Even if you take those steps, if you come back to the classroom and you're still teaching a colonized curriculum, does that really matter? Because at the end of the day, the curriculum still, right? If it's still depicting Black people in a certain way, isn't that really a lot of the issue right there?
No, see, but you need, it's twofold. It is good. Once you're aware, then you can challenge the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started teaching, I wasn't super aware. I mean, I noticed, I was like, why are you talking about slate? But I didn't have the language and stuff. It takes some time. Even as a person of color, once you are aware, then you can challenge the curriculum. And even if it is
still the importance of challenging the curriculum.
Oh, there it is. The importance of how it's necessary. Even if the curriculum is colonized, you can still dismantle it in the practice. You can still, in your practice, you can look at your students and say, I've done this plenty of times. This is why you should challenge the teachers in front of you. This is why you need to challenge the people and what they're teaching you. They gave me a curriculum and I told my kids, and it says, these are your forefathers. Are these white men your forefathers? No, you can dismantle it in that practice. You can have a conversation. Even in that, that is what an educator does. You facilitate. A good educator, you can give me, we will like the good resources. Please give us the best resources. Please give us the monies, because they don't like to. I'm advocating for that. But even if you give me something that is not of high quality, a good educator can take it and still give it back to you, something that can teach teach a student. I've done that many times where I was like, this is, and I've, okay, we're talking about the signing of the Declaration of Independence. What do you guys see? Tell them the truth. Tell them the truth. Thomas Jefferson. Do you know he owned a slave? Yeah, he owned many slaves. Does that mean he really wants people free? I don't. And the kids would ask, and I stir these questions. Even if it's still white centered, you can dismantle white centeredness. That is just as important as giving a decolonized curriculum. Is challenging the new generation to see the importance of a decolonized curriculum. Even
critically
they need to know.
Thinking. Challenge everything.
Everything.
Challenge everything.
Challenge what I'm saying. Go look it up. Correct. Go get Lisa Delpit. Go see if I'm right. And then tell me I'm wrong. Because you know, it helped me do better. But you know, like you said, critical thinking skills are so necessary. But we do want to still have representation matters, right? And it's not just the imagery. You guys posted this earlier. It is including books that represent contemporary Black and Brown authors. And also Tyrell was talking about this before. Why do classics always owe white people?
Mm.
Who deems, if you are an educator, administrator, who deemed this person's theory 100% correct? Who deemed this white educator's theory, or this person who said these are the classics, 100? Why? How is that even applicable to my life as a Black person? God bless you, Jane Austen, but I mean, maybe it is because people love her. I don't know. I like other things. But you understand what I'm saying? Like, there's just other options as well as...
You're absolutely right.
Can I say this one thing real quick? We have to be careful in the literature that is Black and Brown, that it is not fetishized, it is not violence. Because I feel like a lot of Black and Brown struggle is fetishized in literature. It's like really hard, not especially now, hard to find. It's really hard, but it's not easy to find literature that is just a Black and Brown person's life. Fertility struggle, something. No, it has to do with race. There's can we have a story that is not always about white people oppressing us? That's what I'm saying. As well as if you're a kindergarten teacher, you better do your due diligence, because a white child will see 700 books about a little boy named Ricky with a dog before he ever sees a Black boy who had to deal with some foolishness. You know what I mean? Like, there's different, bring your books, bring your literature in there. If you're math and science, when you write your curriculum, put the names of kids who are of color, put the names of your kids in the classroom. It's not like as complicated as people think it is. It's just stop centering whiteness.
Listen, you brought up so many things right there. And one of the things I want to talk about is just that far too often, you know, there are classroom opportunities where teachers can just inject in names. And I think there's so much power in names. If every time we talk about a young man who's violent and Black and his name is Tyrone, even if there's no Tyrone in the classroom, the next time that student encounter someone named Tyrone, they've already got a preconceived notion of, oh, he's named Tyrone, so maybe he's violent. Maybe he's a thug. Maybe he's an illiterate. And mm-hmm. these things are perpetuated over and over, especially, again, we have certain names that we hear. We hear Tyrone. We hear Keisha. You know, these names are utilized Felicia. Over and over. Felicia, right? Instead of using those names, especially in a negative way, mm-hmm. and make sure that you inject them into the conversation in the classroom in positive injecting positive attributes to these characters, whether you're bringing up them in a story or an example. And that's why I talked about, I want to get back to the curriculum, because for far too long, you know, we've taught as educators a U.S. history that's truly devoid, right? It does not give an accurate depiction of Black excellence. Mm-hmm. And it's focused on a race and truth. It's focused on racial oppression.
It's so messed up.
And in a lot of cases, it's focused on uplifting whiteness, right? So,
Right.
I have one example that comes right to the top of my head. We think about the curriculum. I know that I read articles about this, and there was a big push for it, and it needs to be brought up again, where book publisher, textbook provider, McGraw-Hill, right?
Mm. Wow.
In their history books, they represented Africans as immigrants or workers who were enslaved. They were enslaved Africans, but they are labeling them as immigrants and workers as if they came over here by choice. And those are the things that need to be questioned and discussed as to why those things are still being put into history books. But as you mentioned, when you do approach that, and as an educator, you need to full stop right here. Let's discuss this.
Boom. Wait a minute. Hold on. Right. Don't just read through it like it's okay. Like, that's what I said with the Thomas Jefferson. He owned slaves. Did you know he had a relationship with someone he owned? And my kids were like, he had a relationship? He was like, he had children with someone he owned. And my children had enough sense to say, that doesn't sound right. Exactly. You cannot have a consensual relationship with someone you own. Stop perpetuating this pure white idea that these were problematic people. Let's tell the whole truth. You ain't got to keep it a secret. Tell the whole truth. Mm. And I like to what you're saying it with the McGraw-Hill, which has blown my mind because that's a huge curriculum company. Tell the whole truth. There were some very few Africans who came over and worked. And then after a point, it was a wrap. And a majority of people came over who were enslaved. And even that language, my ancestors were not slaves. They were enslaved individuals, or they were in the condition of slavery. Even those things challenging and break. Please help people start using this, incorporating this language.
All of these words matter. The wording is crucial.
Crucial. Or like the fact that people don't know. It's like I showed my kids this. I told them, I said, you know, we United States only had about 300,000, maybe 400,000 Africans brought over. I said a couple hundred, maybe about 100 years later, we had 300, almost 400 million. They said, how'd that happen? And I said, oh, let me tell you about breeding. But we'll talk about that some other time. And I didn't go deep into it. Mm. I just said we were bred. And they said, like animals? I said, exactly. You need to know how people looked at us. You need to be taught the whole truth and also taught the beauty of it. It's like, were they? No, they were blacksmiths. They were craftsmen. They taught how they I forgot his name. He taught a medical doctor how to get rid of smallpox. We were brilliant. There's so many different facets of us. You have to do both sides. And history teachers cannot treat it like it's something foreign, but it also has effects to this day. It is not far away. God bless my indigenous brothers and sisters. They only give them a sound bite. Like it's like a bleep, and they make it sound like they don't exist no more.
Right. You
know, like they ain't around. You know,
we're on their land. Full stop. Enough.
Whole time. There's states named after the peoples who lived here. And there's literally states. But it blows my mind that we're only give that. Don't let me talk about Latinx history. That's not even a thing. Like, for why?
Is that in the history books? I haven't seen it.
Is that in the history books? I don't know. You might get a protest.
So it's up to us. Can I read this quote by Bettina Love? Oh, my goodness.
Bettina. I love
her. I love her, right?
Let me talk about this.
I'm going to put the article in as well. But the quote says, let me be clear. I do not think white teachers enter the profession wanting to harm children of color.
That's right.
They will hurt children whose culture is viewed as an afterthought.
Come on, there it is.
They will hurt a child whose culture is viewed as an afterthought.
Who cares? And don't be and don't be a female, because you a black woman or a woman of color and a female. Oh, you won't even get included in that. You know, can y'all resonate with that? Who are considered an afterthought? And I need white educators to come in that if you are in that mindset and not actively trying, you are hurting your students. Oh, y'all got a question. Y'all gonna read it? Come on now, what's the question? We're gonna read it.
The question is, so what is the goal of decolonizing and truly educating children, the future, appreciate that, of oppressed people to overthrow the system they're in by whatever legal, moral means? What is the purpose? What is our goal?
Pause 1 second. I just wanna address the legal, moral means. You have to be that is precarious to use that language, because legal one time kept us in bondage and that was the law. Sometimes what is legal is wrong. Sometimes what is considered moral is not right, because man in his own eyes sees what's right. And sometimes it's not right, because it was legal to keep us in bondage. It was legal to breed us. It was legal to, it took Batman, Robin, protest, the wind, Black Panther, all of us to unite for somebody to recognize that, you know what, maybe you shouldn't put a knee on somebody's neck. It was going to be legal unless we protested and did things that drew attention. I just want to address that part real quick. We have to be careful when we confine ourselves to legality. I'm not saying go out there and break the law. I'm saying be wise in your decisions to obstruct laws that are harming, especially Black and brown bodies.
Absolutely. So this person rephrased and said, essentially asking, what is the ultimate goal? What is the ultimate goal of providing knowledge of themselves?
What is the true goal of educating children, oppressed people? And then, okay, so the system's already set up to keep us bound, right? So the system, the first part, so what's the true goal of educating children of oppressed people in an inherently oppressive system? The system is working, right? It's supposed to keep us bound. Capitalism and racism are working in tandem together. They're conjoined twins to keep us oppressed. The point is, we cannot keep our minds oppressed. Dr. Carter G. Woodson talked about this, because the Willie Lynch, Dr. Carter G. Woodson, you should read it, The Miseducation Negro Mind. Willie Lynch set this up way back when slavery was popping off. He said, keep the body strong, keep the mind broken, keep the mind weak. Dr. Carter G. Woodson talks about that. Read his book. It's still pertinent to this day.
Mm-hmm.
The miseducation. If I keep you broken in your mind, no, baby, we're going to give them hell.
Many of us are broken right now. We have a lot of repairing to do.
But we're going
to give them a lot of repairing to do.
I want my kids to give them hell. I don't care. Even if the goal seems like it will never change, even if it seems the beauty of it seems far off, I cannot be comfortable as an educator, one, to watch my children become sheep. I cannot set them up for the slaughter. I cannot. If that means that I change the oppressive system one Black man at a time from going into the, I cannot be comfortable with knowing that my child can't. This is what I mean by being a steward of education. It pains me. It emotionally bothers me, the idea that my student will not be set up for success, and instead I let him pass through or her pass through and just be set up for a failure or a system. I need to equip them to fight it any way, shape, form, or fact. Give them hell. I don't. Mm-mm. That's the goal. Even if it don't change, I can't. We're going to go down fighting. I'm not going to let you just go off to the sheet to the slaughter.
It can't. The message can't be, this is the system and it is what it is.
It is what it is.
This is the system, and let me equip you with the knowledge that you need to fight it, right? It has to be both sides of it. I'm going to tell you how it is, but at the same time, we're going to go out there and, like you said, we're going to give them hell for it.
Because if we thought that, then they still would have kept people. We still would have been in that form of slavery. I say that form of slavery because there still is a very strong form of slavery, the plantation and the prison pipeline.
Right. Dick Gregory, says, mm-hmm. So I started reading his book today, and it is incredible. And he says that ignorance is not bliss. It is time consuming and costly as hell.
Mm. Okay? Come on.
And that is from his book, Defining Moments in Black History. And that is just so true. It's costly for us to remain ignorant. When we can't see our value, that we don't know how to add value.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Mm. It requires us to understand that we came from worth and we continue to be from worth and we are worthy.
Mm. I want to throw out there, because how the Black and Brown community has to heal itself, because there are some spaces, if you're white in this season, you're not invited in, because there's spaces we need to heal ourselves. Like, we need to show up for our, it's just, you're not invited, and it's not personal, it's just, you're not invited. Also, I want us to, for all teachers coming out, any teachers who listen to this who are currently teaching or who are coming out, like Bettina Love said, if you look at another child's culture as an afterthought, and I'm not talking about, oh, you came from, this is important. Let me not use that tone. You, because we were Africans first. Oh, you came from Africa. This is that. No, you have to integrate our history with our current. You have to, and not just the struggle. Please show how amazing we are. You got a girl who's a dancer. Tell about Alvin Ellie ASAP. Mm. Please. Tell her about, you got a girl who's a dancer but doesn't know where to go. You do the research as a teacher at your lunch hour. It only take like 10 minutes. Find her some local Black schools that can, you know, that of dance schools. There's different ways. You have to connect our past with our present. And like Bettina said, if you wait for it to be an afterthought and you're just teaching these kids math and science and English and history from a colonized curriculum, you're doing damage. There's also the idea, I forgot the, I sent a Bettina Love article, but it's from a lawyer. It's spirit murdering. You're killing their spirit. You are actively killing their spirit. I'm holding teachers accountable. You are. You're not doing them justice. Please stop thinking you're doing us justice just because you teach. You taught me to read. Thank you. But I'm a whole person, and there's much more to me than that. And if you taught me to read, did you just teach me to read about white folks? Thank you, but no thank you. I don't want that.
Agreed completely. And I just want to reiterate that it comes from here first, and I can't touch my brain, but this is where it comes from. It comes from how you view your students. It really, 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 really comes from checking your bias, essentially the unknown part of why you do what you do.
And you know what's crazy? We're coming up with this at the top, like, from our experiences, but also the top of our head. Like, we're just think. Is that too much?
But it's becoming conscious of that, right? Mm. So you have to realize, first you have to, before you can change a problem, you have to admit there's a problem. So we are all biased. I tell everybody, we're all biased. So it doesn't matter what color you are biased. Now, but some of these biases are more harmful than others, because of where you are. Mm-hmm. And that just needs to be admitted. We don't
where you are and your proximity to power, that you don't know you're a part of this power system, and how you are perpetuating it. Beverly Tatum, read her book. There's another one. I'm trying to help y'all. Just read the books, learn it. Like, I had a situation happen where a student told me that she was in a classroom and another student who's white started touching her hair.
Mm.
And I said, I didn't say, what did you do? Cause it's not her place. She's 11. It's not her place to have to. I said, what the teacher do? She said nothing. I said, oh, that's part of spirit murdering. That's part of keeping that child as an afterthought, their culture as an afterthought. If you are going to an urban Black and Brown community, you need to be a human first and educate yourself about the culture, the experiences. Like, if that was me, I wouldn't have came after that student. I said, hold on, please don't touch her. Because one, if you touch somebody without permission, that's assault. Mm-hmm. Two, let me talk to you afterwards about why you shouldn't touch somebody else's hair, especially if they're a person of color. Because she would just touch and she would tug on it. And I said, what? I said, where was the teacher? She said she just stayed in the front of the class teaching. I said, oh my God.
I can't imagine those things going unaddressed in my class.
I do it all the time. And I mean, Janae, I know you're a natural head. So like, I just feel like, and obviously I know you, Tyrell, are too, but I don't know, maybe as a man, perhaps you have the luxury of people not coming up to you and being like,
I feel like
hello!
They do.
Because
I feel like they touch your hair. I feel like they do, especially when you style it. I'm sure they're like, oh.
I by no means would even attempt to suggest that I've endured as much as my Black sisters have in regards to their hair being touched and prodded and folks making comments about it. I've had a few experiences, but again, not nearly as much. But I don't really understand why someone would think that that's okay to just come up and touch their hair. And that's part of the popular society. As if this is the first time you've ever seen it. It's brand new to you.
My favorite thing was someone said, oh, it's so, I have a negative and a positive experience. And this is why we got to fill our stories with joy, right? I had one experience. I had my hair out and this woman, she's white. She said, oh, it's so wild. And again, I need people to think, because one, you just associate me wild animal, nature, unkempt. There's so many associations. It's a negative connotation. You need to listen to the words coming out your mouth, because then you would be upset if I said, oh, it's so limp and dull. That's not nice. But see, but I'm not going to stoop to your level. I need you just to learn. And then I wore my hair in an afro. And one of my students, he has sensory issues, so he doesn't like people touching his hair, and it's in an afro. And I said, he said, I like your hair. And this is a boy, little boy, and it's that means representation for all of our kids, however mm-hmm. they present themselves. He looked at me, said, I like your hair. I said, I like your hair too. I said, do you know why I wore my hair like this? I said, because you wear your hair like that. And he looked at me and he said, really? He smiled across his face, gave him joy.
Oh my goodness. Thank you for doing that. And I want to make it so clear that I'm not going to straighten my hair. I don't straighten my hair.
Yeah, but like over 6 years.
Exactly. Same. So a big reason why I don't, and this to me is also being intentional and culturally responsive, is because we live in a world where this is not professional, where this is not beautiful, where this is shamed because it's not close to the white standard of beauty. So I'm going to show and demonstrate to everyone that yes, this is professional. Yes. This is beautiful. No, it is not crazy. No, my hair doesn't look crazy right now. No, my hair does not look wild right now. My hair is this. It is a mane and I love it. And I call it a mane because I'm a Leo. That's so, not to go back to the animal thing, but like, it's a big thing. And you need to, and I need to show my young women that you can be beautiful with curly hair and you should accept it and love it. Even while society is telling you that you would be so much prettier if you just straighten your hair. I don't understand how people don't know how damaging that is.
It's political. I mean, it's not, I mean, people don't know. Man, it's been happening forever. You have to think, like, we hit the natural hair movement for like a decade in the 60s, right? And then it fell off. And then we continue to process and straighten our hair because to be in proximity of whiteness is to be honest with you, my grandmother has said, like, why your hair so wild, it's so big and out. I used to get offended, but now I know my grandmother probably said it because it's safer. In her time, it was safer to have it straightened. It was safer to not stand out. But like, you have to think, we recently just hit the natural hair movement about 10 years ago hard. And even before that, we would straighten our hair like it was nobody's business. For my Latinos, it was the plancha. You know, it's like nobody's business. But like, if you teach in an urban ed community and you see your girls coming in with certain hairstyles, why don't you go Google that? Why don't you go look it up? Why don't you go understand what a sew-in is, a braid out is, difference between weave and different types, how that's done. Why don't you go look it up? Why don't you go inform yourself so you can appreciate that when she says she doesn't wash her hair, it's not because she's dirty. It's because she has a different hair texture than you and that she takes care of her hair differently. You need to learn to appreciate those things, learning to appreciate and respect that.
And again, I just want to point out, it's not necessarily just learning. It's challenging. Mm-hmm. Why do I feel like that makes her dirty? Why does not doing what I do lead to dirty?
So stop being ethnocentric.
Right. And so that requires,
I don't judge you for not using lotion or cleaning your chicken. It is not cleaning your rice. I don't judge you for that. I just say I'm not going to eat your chicken, but I don't judge you for not cleaning your rice or cleaning your meat.
You have to.
Or putting raisins in potato salad. That's you.
And carrots.
I'm not mad that you make jollof rice and make it mushy. I just won't eat it. That's not what jollof rice looks like. You know what I'm talking about? That was going around the internet. She was like, my mom. And we was like, that. Everybody, especially my West Africans, was like, that is not. And they was like, you foolish goat. That's what they said. I celebrate my people. I love y'all. Y'all don't be playing. Oh, y'all be like, you're a foolish goat.
She made rice puree or something. I'm not.
And it was, I know you, Tyrell said, if you, who? How?
I'm not really, maybe it was yams. I don't know.
She said it was jollof rice. And I was like, first off, if you know how to make rice, period.
You know what, though, to be honest, in that video that you're discussing, because it's the one of the singers from Pentatonix.
Yeah.
I wasn't as mad at her as I was of him. Because he was so excited to present it.
Why he played her like that?
Authentic. And I recognized in that moment that he didn't know. So how could I then expect her to know?
Ooh, you speaking true. Dropping gems.
So I really, truly wasn't that mad at her at all. I was truly looking at him like, brother, you need to educate yourself so that way you can educate her, because that's the true tragedy here.
That is. If you're going to be in that relationship. So let's talk about those actionable steps, right?
Right. Let's recap. We need people to leave here with some actionable steps that they're going to take with them into their virtual classrooms, into their hybrid classrooms, into their full classrooms, whatever it is that they're going to move
into life
in the next few months. I'll start, right? Because I begin. And so really consider and start off by asking yourself, how does your power and your privilege show up in your work with your students? How does it take up space? And how does it silence others, right? And really think about that in the sense of imaging. What images do you present in the presentations that you utilize through Google Slides and PowerPoints? What is up on your walls? Is it pictures of your students? Is it
don't wait for Black History Month?
No.
That's insulting a little bit.
Right. And really, what I want people to understand is we're not looking for a classroom that only displays Black and Brown faces, right? We're looking for a classroom with balance that has to be representative of the kids you have in your classroom and representative of the history of our country, the history of your subject area, especially if we're talking about, like for me as an ELA teacher in literature, I really want to make sure that I'm promoting the authors that my students can connect with, because if we're only talking about stories that don't connect to their lives in any way, shape, or form, then I'm doing them a disservice. And then the last thing I would just simply say is consider the names that you use when you provide examples and when you are doing you're in conversations in class, because the names have power, and the students, whether they're in your class and they have that name and they feel some type of way about it, or the students that they'll encounter leaving class, they will then internalize those thoughts that you presented to them, positive or negative. So if you potentially use certain names in a positive light, when they meet Keisha, they'd be like, oh, we talked about Keisha being a scientist in class. We talked about Keisha being a scholar. We talked about Keisha being a politician, an engineer, a doctor, a lawyer, right? We talked about Keisha in a chef. Ways.
A Keisha chef. Is an entrepreneur. She travels the world.
Right. We talked about Tyrell as a coder. We talked about Tyrell as an activist. We talked about Tyrell in such positive ways that when I meet Tyrell, my expectations are sky high.
The Tyrells I've been exposed to in my classroom, they have he's a wonderful father. Because it said Tyrell has two children. He comes home every day and brings them fruit. 5 apples, 6 bananas. Hey, look at that. You just got culture responsive. Look at you help that out. Look at you. Here he fed them fruit. Healthy.
Healthy living.
Healthy living.
Recap your steps, Janelle.
Okay. So one, I really believe it's on a human perspective at first. And that speaks to Joe's bias thoughts. It's just, how can you not center yourself? How can you not just be the only person? Excuse me. How can you make sure you not see yourself, but see everybody in what you teach? Mm-hmm. And that goes from making sure that you talk to your administration about the curriculum you're presenting. And if it's if you're doing Black and Brown literature, make sure it's not literature that just talks about our struggle. Let it be about, it can be about relationships. It can be about, like I said, a woman's fertility issues. It could be about someone traveling the world. It does not have to be a story tied to pain. We know this. Also, make sure you advocate and push your administration to pull in or put you to professional developments about anti-racism or just expose you to these different things. Make sure you access the literature, Beverly Tatum, Lisa Delpit, Latin Billings, and Pedagogy of the Press. There's an array of literature you can access. But make sure you're not ethnocentric. Make sure it's just not like about you. And you can't, when you go in, like Benita Love, read Benita Love, what she said. You can't go in and just have your children's culture as an afterthought. And I'm not just talking about Black community, because you'll be in a Latino, you'll be in the Asian community. You need to humble yourself. Take your skills and ask how you can be of service. Ask how you can, and also, I can't push to what Tyrell said. If it's not in the classroom, like Joe said, if it's out, ask them about the relationships at home. They have cultural capital. They have funds of knowledge that you can bring in. If you're having trouble with how you're connecting, learn how they connect with the people in their life. Learn how they build relationships. Don't assume you know. After 4 years an education degree teaches about theory. Some schools have culturally responsive pedagogy and different things of that nature, but it's in practice, it's every day. You need to push for these professional developments. You need to ask for professional developments that help you be equitable. You need to say, can you send me to a PD? I found one that'll help us be more conscious in our curriculum. You need to look and push, and you need to advocate with your power and authority, knowing that if you are a white educator, to be honest with you, you can say stuff. Black and brown people can, but you have a comfort level of saying stuff, knowing you might not be dismissed. You might not be fired. You might not be excused from coming back next year. You have certain luxuries that we don't. I can promise you can ask any Black or brown person, has there been times they said, I kept my mouth shut because I just need to leave it alone. We have to pick our battles. There's some you don't. So again, it's really learning and make sure you engage with their parents. Like I said, ask them, how do they build relationships at home, mom and dad? How are they with their brother and sister? Ask them, because you might find out that that child lives in a two-family home, is supported, has positivity, but they have four siblings and they're the second to the last. So in that classroom you're teaching in, teachers, they need your attention a special way. They have support at home. They come from two family. And you learn to look past the stereotype of that they were this Black or brown child in a big family, because that's a stereotype and that's a bias that people just be popping out babies. Get past that and learn that maybe that child's acting that way because they need some special attention. That's it. They need to have lunch with you once a week so they can talk, because they're the second of four in their parents' work. It's not bad. It's not that they're trying to act out. It's they need different types of support. Again, it's not about you. It's building those relationships. Mm-hmm. It's looking outside of your white context. It's making sure their culture is not an afterthought. It's learning to celebrate your students and put them in a place where they can challenge the status quo. And that starts with you challenging your status quo, your biases. Yep. If you want more information, I consult. Because some of this can't be for free forever. Mm-mm. Y'all, I ain't gonna front. Some of this can't be free forever.
Book coming soon.
Listen. We need to get some sponsorships. I really feel it, because like people want this information for us, which we don't mind giving. At the same time, they don't know the struggle that went through to getting this. Like, this is lived experiences. We all learned at an early child what racism was and what we could and could not do in this world. If we figured out at three, and we got a lifelong of experience, I'm just saying, y'all gonna start running us our ducats.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my goodness. So yes,
Janae, Tyrell's an expert at being a Black man. He is an expert at being a Black man. You can't get, I'm just saying. He could tell me stuff I don't know.
To use a Chris Emden quote, my experience is my expertise.
Come on now. Come on, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying.
So yes, please check your biases, people. It really does start in order to truly be effective, because you can put up posters, you can put your kids' names in the questions, but if you haven't checked your bias to see how to connect and truly want to connect and build those bridges and see them as worthy and see them as capable and see them as a true true, like see them in their true capability of the futures.
You teach to their future.
Correct.
Teach to their future.
Correct. And if you see their future down here, then that's where you're teaching them. Oh. So you need to check that. You really need to check that in order to truly gain insight into them and see that insight as valuable. Because you can gain insight and think it's nothing, but it isn't. It is something and it is valuable. And if you want to see them in that way, you have to check how you see them. And that comes from you doing the internal work. And as I've said before, listen, it will be hard. It will be painful. You will be like, what? Oh my God, am I a bad person? And the truth is you're not a bad person, but you do need to do the work. Mm-hmm. You do need to do this work and you will feel some things come up. Sit with those feelings. Where did they come from? Remember, you were probably a part of a colonized education and these mental constructs, right?
Yes.
These mental constructs are a result of that. And you experiencing that helps you realize exactly why you as well need to move forward in decolonizing your curriculum, in thinking about the way you act and treat people of color, Black people. It's imperative, but it starts up here because this is where you find value. This is where you decide what is valuable, and this is where you start generating your actions. Mm. So it's mental first.
Can I throw one more thing in there? Pour into them, love them, respect them, honor them, celebrate them. Pour into them, love them, honor them, respect them, celebrate. Pour. Listen. I forgot her name. She passed away. She did a TEDx. She's amazing. She said she had a student come to her, and she said the student said, "I got 18 wrong," but she said, "You got 2 right. You have to have an asset-based mindset. You got 2 right. You pushing towards your greatness. Don't focus on the negative," and especially for my white colleagues, go get the money, because you make up 80% of the teaching population. Go get the money, 83% approximately. Go get the money. Go get the monies. Go ask your administration how we can grant money. Go get the money for your kids, especially in urban ed, because property taxes are not allocated correctly and there's not a proper distribution of wealth because we live in a capitalistic, terroristic system. So what you need to do is go get that grant money for these kids. Go get that money. Go find ways to provide for them. Go find things to help so they have an outlet. Go push. Okay, that's it. Go get the money.
I'm pretty sure you were referring to Rita Pearson. I think that's who you're talking about.
Rita Pearson. Yes, God rest her soul. She was phenomenal.
Every kid is a champion. One of the best TED Talks. One of the most viewed TED Talks as well.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I was sad when I heard she's right, though. It's not as complicated. That's a culturally responsive pedagogy. Every kid needs a champion. Every kid needs a coach. They don't need you to save them. They don't need you to save them. They fine. You can know what? Here's another tip. Coach responsive. It's okay if your kid cries. People like when I say that. It's okay if they get frustrated and they tear up and it's hard. Nothing. It's not going to be easy. But you have to be there and say, "But I know you can do it, and I'm here with you. I'm here with you in your tears. I'm here with you in your struggle because I know what you can become. I know the greatness that lies before you, and I will not let you settle." That's what it means to be coach responsive teacher.
Right.
I can go on for days.
We got to wrap this thing up.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. I want to repeat what you said. Pour into your students. Love them, honor them, respect them. So yeah, no, thank you for that. That was beautiful. So honestly, if you haven't done so already, please remember to listen to us. Please remember to follow us. We are everywhere as 2B Podcast. And in the meantime, remember.
To be good to yourself.
To be true to yourself.
Wait.
To educate yourself.
We were supposed to practice.
We almost did. But listen, we're going to leave you guys with a song that's really moving us right now. And that's J. Cole's January 28th.
Oh, yes.
What you know about Cole Thursday. World?
Yeah. I know myself. I rip a page out my notebook in anger and start slang or singing. Don't give them too much juice. Don't let them take control. It's one thing you do. Don't let them take your soul. Believe in God. One thing's for sure. You ain't aim too high. You ain't too low. And you ain't too low. What's the price for a Black man life?
I check the toe tag, not one zero in sight. I turn the TV on, not one hero in sight, unless he dribble or he fiddle with Mike.